Brad, you know this band, Coheed and Cambria?
You know, I don't. As I was listening to it, I was thinking, this should be in my repertoire, but I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, check them out. Coheed and Cambria, they are, well, I'm going to say this, and I know Andrew and Wheels will both have an opinion on it. They're kind of pop metal. You know, some of their songs are really metal, but then some like that are a little more palatable for people like me that aren't super into metal. But
kind of on the progressive side, but yeah. but very catchy. They excel with the catchiness. They're very good at writing stuff catchy.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yes. Brad, before we get into your Brad stories, I got to get your take on the president's Houdini magic trick that he pulled in Turkey.
Oh, I don't know that I have any particular analysis of it. It shows you, though, that the threat, which isn't uncommon with presidents, the threat was from Iran was far greater than what we were told. It wasn't just that he changed planes. And my analysis initially was he changed planes because the new airplane from Qatar doesn't have defensive measures on it. And now we find out that because they were smuggling him away in like a food truck or a luggage transport truck over to a different aircraft that nobody knew about, that shows you that the threat was far greater than what we were initially told.
Yeah, my problem with it is, from what I understand, he left his staff and the press pool ass out on the old Air Force One. Because they all thought he was on it, and anyone looking to blow it up thought that he was on it, and he was too afraid to be on it, or he would have flown back on it, but he snuck out like Taylor Swift. That doesn't it bother you that he left those people in danger?
Well, I guess I'm trying to look at it from the Secret Service standpoint. They wouldn't want to tell anybody because, frankly, they're bait. Okay.
That's the point.
Right. I know that, but from a Secret Service standpoint, they're not charged with protecting the press. They're charged with protecting the president, and bureaucrats always look at things the same way. Right. And that is this is classic bureaucracy 101. If something goes really badly and I have to testify in front of the Senate, what am I going to say? And I'm sure the analysis on this was, oh, no, we kept the president on the plane because we didn't want to upset the press and the other members of his staff. And he would be grilled on Capitol Hill for that. So they did the safe thing. Move the president. Don't tell anyone. Let the Iranians think he's still on the plane. If they light up a missile, see ya. But otherwise, they've protected the president.
Right. But I'm not a genius, but you could have pulled this whole Houdini thing. Let him get on the other plane early and leave. And then after he's gone, say, yeah, you know what? We're not flying today because of this risk. We're going to move all you to other places. Like, you could have waited till he was gone before saying, okay, guys, we got a deplane. The president's ahead. He's already, you know, in England. We'll get you guys off the plane and we'll transport you at a better time. But the reason we moved him because there was a threat. Like, I don't see why there has to be a bait plane. I think that's a horrible decision.
Well, here's and listen, this falls right into line with what Marines do with Marine One. The president is picked up. It's been this way for decades at the White House by the Marine helicopter. There are three of them, and they play a game of hide the president shell game with the three helicopters, and they move and they do like the hat dance at Bush Stadium, and they move around, and the other two helicopters rather are targets. That reduces the chance of hitting the president to one out
but
of three
in on it.
And I'm sure that same analysis, though, you're right, they are in on it,
and they're active
but
duty
that
military.
Same analysis went to play here.
Yeah, I mean, I do not buy any explanation that there was no other way to do this. I'm sorry, but they have amazing resources, and all it would take is just a slight change in timing, and you could have done this without putting everybody out there as bait. I mean, that's hundreds of people.
I don't
on
disagree.
That
sure, and I don't disagree that there's probably other ways of doing it, but the risk calculation would be what is the safest way for the president? And beyond that, there's not really a calculation. And that's what the Secret Service determined. Could it have been done differently? Absolutely. But maybe those other options increased risk to the president.
The one that I just put out there would not have increased the risk to the president at all. You spear him off that plane. You take him to the new plane, which is what you were already doing. New plane leaves. Half hour later, you deplane everybody off of Air Force One because he's gone. He's no longer in that airspace. He's already up halfway to Europe.
The problem with being so conclusive is there's a lot of information that we don't know. I mean, we didn't know anything about this 24 hours ago. So we don't know what we don't know, and it's hard to say that any other option would have been just as safe.
But we do know what we do know. That's sort of like when Christians say, oh, kids get bone cancer because God works in mysterious ways. Like, based on what we do know, it's bullcrap. And I just flatly disagree with you. The president's life is not so important that you risk 300 American lives when he can spend another night in Turkey. You know, like there are ways to do this that do not involve using 300 American innocent citizens as bait. Like, I understand the whole, like, hide him in a barrel and take him to another plane. They've done that with other presidents. Yeah. I get that. Yeah. But to my my understanding is no one's ever done it like this, where they allowed others to fly in Air Force One knowing that there was a credible threat against it, but the president wasn't in it, so it's okay.
I'm sorry if we've already covered this, but do we know like how serious the threat was? Has that been revealed? Because, I mean, maybe it was a very minor threat, and out of an abundance of caution, the president just wanted to do that. I mean, I'm just asking questions. Yeah. I don't know the answer to these questions.
I think my take would simply be, if there's enough risk for the president to change planes, then the lives of those other people need to be considered also. I mean, they have the full force of the United States military at their disposal. It's not like the four of us are making a plan with what we can figure out.
No, and I'm not suggesting you're wrong at all, Wheels. What I'm suggesting is that from the analysis of the Secret Service, they frankly wouldn't care about those other things. Now, we stepping back, because their job is to protect the president. That's it. So I'm not saying it's the right decision. What I'm saying is that is the priority of the Secret Service.
And what I'm saying is there are higher priorities than the Secret Service and the president's safety. And I think this is a higher priority.
Yeah, understood.
I would not prioritize his life over the life of 300 innocent Americans.
I think if it was a case where it was something that was happening more quickly, like there's a shooting or something and you're the Secret Service, your first job and only job is rush the president out of here and not worry about anybody else. Completely agree. When you have advanced time and all of the tools at the disposal that the United States government has, there is no, to me, there's not a choice between those two things. Those two things go very neatly together. We can easily protect the president the way that he needs to be protected and also not fly those people as if they're bait. Like, that, it's not an either or. You can do both.
All I'm saying is that Harrison Ford managed to kill all the terrorists and hold on by a rope.
Get off my plane!
Outside of Air Force One, and this guy's getting taken in a taco truck.
I'm sorry to continue it, but like, I don't know if I view it as them being bait. The way I'm kind of reading it, not knowing what the threat was like, what if the president was told, like, oh, yeah, there's a blip on our radar here, but everything's going to be fine. And then he went, yeah, I'm not doing that. I'm leaving, though. Like, it was fine to proceed, but he didn't want to proceed.
I don't understand why that matters, though. Because if it is...
Because he's under threat all the time. There's always going to be a shadow of a threat, right?
I mean, that's the existence that he chose, yeah.
But, okay, the way I would look at that, Rach, is his very favorite toy in the world, Qatari 1. He didn't fly on that, so something was bad enough to make him too afraid. And then he was so afraid that he wouldn't fly on the old Air Force 1, and he's so afraid that he got into a food truck and flew back on a crappy plane. So that tells me something about the level of the threat.
Well, but maybe he was overreacting to the level of the threat.
Okay, that's fine. But
so then,
no,
is the
President Trump doesn't overreact.
But then is the Secret Service then at his whim to what he's overreacting to, and then it's their responsibility to now care for hundreds of other people because of the whim of the person ultimately calling the shot?
Evidently so. I mean, I don't see, I mean, there are people online commenting too, and I disagree with all of you. I don't see a scenario where it's okay.
Dave Hines, no, I don't think the president is the one who makes the call on security ops, but I think if he wanted to take another plane, they could make it happen.
Yeah, I think it's a push and pull. In the moment, the Secret Service has say-so. They can physically grab the president
right.
and make him
like
leave.
In that incident, like in Pennsylvania,
but
when you had the
food truck wasn't just sitting there and they said, hey, why don't we put him in that? I mean, they knew what they were doing.
Planning went into this.
Now, maybe something new will come out that will soften my view on this. But as far as we know right now, whoever was making the threat thought that the president was on the old Air Force One, thus making that plane in special danger. And they did that on purpose. They wanted whoever the threat was from, Iran, to think that the president was on that plane so that he could get away on the other plane. And so they are clearly using those people as bait. I'm not sure that's the best word, but they are comfortable with them being in danger just so the president gets away. That, and maybe I'm just stupid, that seems completely un-American to me.
But don't you think that, I don't think you're stupid, Dave. I'm just saying, like, don't you think this kind of thing happens constantly?
The
president's life is going to be prioritized over 300 innocent. The president's life is probably going to be prioritized over 5,000 innocent Americans,
sure,
quite frankly.
I guess this is back to my point on
and
this.
And I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that's how it is.
But this isn't that choice. When you have time to cook up an alternative plan, then you have time to also cook up an alternative plan for those other people that are on the plane.
Yeah, but see, again,
it's not an either or. There's no reason to not do both. I mean, the president leaves in the other plane, and then a period of time later, all right, everybody, off the plane. We got a thing we got to deal with. We're looking out for you.
Well, I just know a guy. I know a guy in the Secret Service. He has been on presidential details for past presidents. I've talked with him as often as I humanly possibly can. And he's still in the service right now. But I will tell you that he has repeatedly told me on different scenarios that the sole focus of the Secret Service when the president is en route anywhere, their sole focus is his or her safety. That's it. They don't go beyond that analysis.
But that's and not now, the end of the story. I understand what you're saying, and I believe that that is true. But that is not the end of the analysis.
I don't see that from a Secret Service standpoint, there's any analysis after that.
But the Secret Service
that's not their
isn't,
job.
But the Secret Service isn't God. The Secret Service isn't the final say on 300 other people's
but who
lives.
Who is supposed to organize it? I think that's what we're running up against, is who is going to organize getting all of those people home.
Well, I mean, if you think about all of the staffers and people that are on that plane, I'm sure some of them have some connections to the Department of Defense. I'm sure that if you just do the thing you got to do with the president, get him out of harm's way, but inform someone else who can then take those steps. I don't get why that's a problem. Because everything I'm talking about is the president's gone already. He has gone down the food truck. He's on the new plane. The new plane is taken off. It is out of Turkey. Boom. Now we move. Now we do something else so that this is not just a plane where it's like, oh, yep, there's bait. I'm not a genius,
but
that just seems like a very simple process.
I'm not trying to like argue. I'm looking at it through like, it's so easy to be like, they shouldn't have done it like that. That's not how it should have happened. That is so easy. What's not easy is figuring out and planning it and knowing how things actually work. That's not what Secret Service says. Brad has told us repeatedly in this segment, the Secret Service is there to protect the president. They're not there to organize a flight home for Marco Rubio or
they don't have
was
to
on the
organize
flight.
It. They have to get the president out safely and then notify someone.
My problem,
notify the chief of staff.
My problem
notify
is
someone.
That the people on Air Force One that Iran was led to believe Trump was on, and they're already planning on blowing it up for whatever reason. That wasn't happenstance. That wasn't a coincidence. That was part of the plan. Part of the plan was for Iran to think that the president was on this plane, thus putting it in danger, but it was 200 other innocent Americans who were on that plane. My problem is that was a part of the plan. Now, if all of you out there who are calling me naive are cool with that, if you or your spouse or your kids were on that plane and you're like, hey, Secret Service, they're the Lord of all, then we're different kinds of people. I don't think that the Secret Service or any branch of government should intentionally, as part of their plan, use American citizens as bait.
But Dave, what I'm saying is there a possibility that this was really not a credible threat?
Sure.
And the president could have very well been on that plane, and he said, I'm not getting on the plane. Because I don't think the Secret Service can force him. You know, I think if he says, like, I'm not doing that, then they're going to find an alternate route for him unless his life is in immediate danger. What I'm saying is this could have just been an overreaction on a couple of people's part and not like, and we're sending you guys to your deaths. Goodbye. Like, you're definitely going to get shot down. Like,
yeah, but you're pinning your position on something that may or may not be true. And it's.
But you're pinning your position on these people were sent out as bait. We don't know that.
How? Yes, we do.
I mean, no, it was called a decoy.
Then why wasn't
what is a decoy?
Did the plane land safely? Is everyone alive?
Yeah, and it could not
and
have.
And they thought the president was on the plane, but they, like, that's what I'm saying is it obviously wasn't that credible of a threat because nothing happened, right?
No, if it's enough of a threat for the president to say, I'm not doing this, then it should be enough of a threat that those other lives are also considered. Even if he's overreacting, even if the person who made the choice for the Secret Service, whether it was the president or, you know, his chief in charge, whatever, anyone thinks that that's enough for him to go, it's enough to then, after the fact, after the president is safe, to consider that for those other people, too. Because I agree, the president is the priority. But he's not the only option is to just do this and everyone else.
I feel like you didn't listen to anything I just said.
I heard everything
argument.
You said, and I understand everything you're saying, but you're pinning it on a maybe that we don't know. But what we do know is whether the old man freaked out or there was really, truly a credible threat. They went through a plan. They took this guy off of one plane, faked him on another plane, put him on a food truck, put him on a third plane. He was subpoenaing the records of the New York Times who leaked this to keep this from coming out. Obviously, they didn't want this to come out because of how it looks. So, yes, they didn't get blown up. I'm going to guess that most credible threats don't happen, but they're still credible threats. And I'm just not comfortable allowing a credible threat against American citizens as a decoy, which is what they're calling it, so that the president can get away. Brad, good fight. Thank you, man.
My pleasure.
All right, we went really long there fighting. And just so you know,
I thought we had lost Brad by the end.
Oh, he's probably never coming back.
He's like, you guys.
I think we scared him. Just so you know, we're all cool with each other. We just are not happy with you on the stream. So,
correct.
This is what we do.
Correct.
When we're mad at each other, we're like, F Dave Hines. You know what? That piece of crap. So we thank you for that. You are our bait plane.
Mom and Dad are fighting, and it is your fault, kids.
Yeah. Yeah, look, and then you walked into the room, and we're like, and you didn't even do your homework last night.
And what do you have to say about this?
Hey, all I know is my only job is to protect Dave. All the rest of you suckers are going down.
That's right. That makes more sense.
When you put it that way.
Put it that way. Got a real point. Every day I should be wheeled in some sort of a bin.
catering truck like you're an assassin. Catering, you know, the thing
sort
with the waiter.
Disguise.
Yeah. Met you before the fall.
Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. Time to talk to our pal, Ricky Horton. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Dave, how are you today?
Good, buddy. I will be seeing you tonight. Some people paid a lot of money at an auction to help a charity, so I'm going to be up there in the third inning to say hello.
Nice. I did see that, and I'm excited about that. And, you know, hopefully we'll have a good game for everybody, too.
Yeah, boy, last night, I mean, we've been blown out. We've blown out others, but typically they're close games. But it was a good game. It was a fun game, but, you know, frustrating at the end, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, the comeback was terrific that the Cardinals had in the eighth inning. Five hits in the eighth inning. They figured it out. They got things going, and it was just a little bit too short and too late maybe to make that happen. They had opportunities, though. It's odd, you know, Dave, you think back early on in the season when the Cardinals built to +8. They were 8 games over .500. They were winning all of those games. I mean, all of them. They were winning the one-run games. And, you know, it doesn't – you know, that's not going to be sustainable, obviously. And, you know, I don't think there's any one thing that you can point to other than the fact that the Cardinals gave away some stuff. You know, they had a lot of walks and a couple of errors, and that – kind of made the deficit too big.
Yeah, those from inside, like, I can't imagine that those are the losses that you get over easy. It seemed like Ollie was pretty upset last night because that's the one where you feel like if you just do what you can control, you probably win that game.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Ollie did a little introspection and said, you know, coulda, shoulda, woulda done this. But, you know, of course it's always easy to look back, you know, later and say, you know, well, what if? And, you know, I mean, when you're in the arena, you're not the critic. When you're in the arena, you don't get the what ifs. You got to decide right then and right there. And so, but I do think it's good that Ollie was able to show his vulnerability and say, well, maybe, you know, if I pinch hit here, maybe I should have done that. Because I think what that does is it sets an example for the players to say, you know, what could I have done better and learn from it, as opposed to, you know, kind of defending every little thing you do. And, you know, because it is a game of kind of getting better and managing mistakes and making adjustments.
I'm going to tell you right now, the best ball player on the team is JJ. Not far behind, in my estimation, not far at all, is Burley.
Yeah. I think you keyed 1-2. So, I mean, in my mind, they're both the same. Not the same, but they both give you crazy good at-bats. Their ability to do things offensively is extraordinary. Now, and Weatherholt, of course, has the plus on the defensive side, too, which I think is why he's going to be the rookie of the year. I really do think he will. But he's fun. I mean, every time he comes to the plate, something good's going to happen. That's what I think. And Burley, same thing. And Burley especially has bat-to-ball skills that are elite. He can hit good pitching. He can hit bad pitching. Now, he's going to have his bad moments. But his ability to do damage, he's actually, 330 with runners in scoring position, so he's a clutch guy, too. I mean, Burley's kind of got the whole package.
Am I just taking drugs that I think Burley should be at least in the conversation about a gold glove?
Yeah, you know, I don't know, but I'd say yes in the conversation, and I don't know what drugs you might be using, but, you know, we'll talk about that later. But I do think he is way better than we thought he would be. You know, he's got a significant number of errors, which I think is problematic for. Yeah, no, he does. I think he's got 6 or 7 or maybe 8 errors. And so he's had some lapses, but I mean, not lapses, but imperfections, as we all do. But way kind of kicking better than we thought he would do. And so I feel like he's going to keep getting better and better. He's working at it for sure. I think he's in the conversation, yes.
Yeah, I mean, put it this way. If you told me right now Burley's going to be the first baseman for the Cardinals for the next 5 years, I'm cool. I'm good with that.
I'm in with that, too. Speaking of gold gloves, Michael McGreevy needs to get a gold glove. I'm kind of on the bandwagon for that. So he's got the most defensive runs saved or outs above average, one of the two, of pitchers in all of baseball. And when you watch him field his position, you think, okay, that's a shortstop pitching. That's a guy that can play, and he holds runners really well. You know, I don't see a guy that's better than him, frankly. So I feel like, you know, I know he wants that. I think he deserves that. The numbers say that. I think the more we talk about that, the better.
Yeah, that's a good call. And that's, It's not thought of all the time, Ricky, because, you know, I mean, pitchers don't get that many chances, but when they do get them,
yeah,
they're important. You know, it's a tight play at first. It's a bunt play. Well, you know, it's something that matters.
How about the play yesterday and not picking on Hunter Dobbins, who, by the way, is a better golfer than Michael McGreevy. I found that out. I asked McGreevy, are you the best golfer on the team? He said, I'm the best golfer unless Dobbins is here. And he's scratched. He's way better than me. But McGreevy's actually really good, too. But, I mean, they're both athletes. But Dobbins did something that you see pitchers do all the time. He kind of rushed a play and threw the ball away, which may have been the biggest play in the game yesterday. But, you know, and actually he pitched very well. So I'm you know, give him some credit for that. But, you know, pitchers throwing to first base on a ground ball to them is a mystery sometimes. Guys just can't do it.
Yeah.
But McGreevy gets it done very well.
Can you explain, Ricky, like to the listener, the difference there? Because, you know, pitchers are really precise within the strike zone, but they're also usually from a stationary position on their own pace versus moving your feet, going a different direction, changing directions. What's the biggest challenge there?
So they're so used to, as a pitcher, you're so used to, first of all, you're throwing downhill off of a mound, and you're doing that 9 million times every week. So that's your frame of reference. Now you're making a different throw in a different situation and to a different target, and everything is kind of, it's the wild, wild west for pitchers, and it looks like it sometimes. So what George Kisler used to teach us, because he said, once the ball's hit to you, you're an infielder. I want you to think like an infielder, and the first thing you do is you take the ball out of your glove and you listen to the ball. That's what he used to say. I mean, like, wait, listen to the ball. And what he was saying is, bring the ball to your ear and do a short throw, do a short snap throw like an infielder might, instead of a long arm throw. And when you do, because when you go long, like you are in a pitching motion, that never works. It just doesn't. I mean, because you try to throw the ball slowly that way, it doesn't work. Yeah, pitchers can't lob the ball. They just can't. They throw hard. So he always says, listen to the ball, snap throw. That's how you should do it from the mound as well.
It's interesting because, you know, obviously not nearly the same level, but the same idea. As a catcher, Ricky, if I got stuck in the outfield for a game in summer ball, my throws were always low. I just couldn't retrain that angle because I'm so, you know, it's as a catcher, everything's down to the bag, just like a pitcher, everything's downhill, and it's a weird thing.
That's a perfect example. It really is. And, you know, you talk about let's talk about Jose Fermin for a minute, who, by the way, is way underrated about how much fun it's been to watch him and how good he's been defensively. Yes, he's smiling all the time. We love him. But I think production-wise, he's been good, too. But the throw at third base is different than the throw at second base.
Mm-hmm.
It's different than the throw in left field. It's even different than the throw in center field. So, but he's been able to kind of make some adaptations really fast and adjustments. And I just think what he's done is extraordinary because the throwing is complicated and it is nuanced from position to position.
Yeah, that's one of the things that impresses me about utility guys, to be honest with you, is that ability to kind of shape shift into, and I know they work on it, you know, I mean, they practice doing that.
Yeah, they do.
But it's not easy.
I think J.J. Weatherholt has a better arm as a second baseman than a shortstop. And I can't tell you kind of why that is, but I mean, watching him throw, and it's not about arm strength, I just think he's smoother. I mean, he's crazy smooth as a second baseman. And when he plays short, I'm always kind of wondering what's going to happen. And I'm not picking on him. I'm just saying he's so good at second, but it's a different throw. It's a different angle. It's a different requirement to make the kind of throw that Mason Wynn makes. I mean, Mason Wynn does things that very few people on the planet can do.
So, guys, we're, as I understand it from you guys, coming up on the date when you can start bringing guys up from AAA?
Yeah, 15th or 16th is when you can get to underneath the threshold for Rookie of the Year for next year,
Who do you expect?
Yep. Exactly. Baez will be here. I mean, I think. I mean, I would be stunned if he's not. I mean, he's hit 33 home runs in AAA.
Jeez.
What the move will be, I don't know, Kevin. But that's the first thought. And I think, you know, we're probably going to see Quinn Matthews again because we got a doubleheader in Cincinnati. You got the 27th man. I would be stunned if he's not the guy there. And then whenever that extra date is where you can bring him back up again, I suspect we'll see him too.
Yeah, September 1st, we'll get one of each, right? We'll get a position player and a pitcher. I would think Baez before that, but maybe Quinn after that full-time, but before that, like you said, Ricky, for the doubleheader where you can come and go without having a penalty.
guys.
Yeah, and if there's any, well, but the other thing is there's innings, innings concern about all of our starters that's going to come into play with that.
Yep.
Is there a defensive comp for Baez that people out there can go, oh, okay, he's this kind of guy?
So strong arm,
yep.
Good defender. I mean, not Willie Mays. So that's not the comp. Boy, I'd have to think maybe, I wouldn't say Church because I think Church is a really good defender. I'm not sure, Kevin, who's in between Church and, I mean, maybe he's like Jordan Walker right now.
I mean, I would think he's probably more of a natural tracker of the ball because he does play some center, but I don't think that's where he's going to play in the big leagues.
Like, yeah, that's right.
And he has the arm for right field, but not maybe Jordan's arm. He's kind of a hybrid, to be honest. Right. I would put it this way. I think he profiles as a well above average left fielder defensively.
Yeah, well, I think Everson Ferreira is actually that profile too, mm-hmm. but I haven't seen him enough to use him as a comp. But we've been told very good things about his defense, and he may be the second best Cardinal defender in the outfield position right now.
Very cool. All right, buddy. I'll see you in a couple hours.
All right. Good. I look forward to it. The West was won.
GS and KMOX reminding you all that Dave Glover Band is playing 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. this Sunday evening at Frankie Martin's out in Cottleville. It's my first 3-hour gig in about 5 years. So, maybe you could go to Calgary and bet how many songs in my voice blows out.
Do we know the forecast for Sunday?
Hot. For a while, it was like high of 83. Now I think it's more like a high of 90. So
better be drinking some water up on that stage.
Yep. It's a good thing that it's 7 to 10.
So with that, I was going to say, especially since it's at night, is it better to have the heat and the warmth for performing, like as a singer, or is it neutral, worse?
You know, from a voice standpoint,
yeah.
I think the cold is probably worse.
Okay.
But
dry would be worse, right?
Believe it or not, my vocal instrument is not so finely tuned. that I recognize the change in temperature. I remember one time we played out in Cottleville, ironically, at the St. Patrick's Day, and it was so cold and like spitting ice that Jimmy Griffin was wearing gloves to play guitar. Yeah.
It
was
and he can do that?
They're like half gloves, but yeah, that was pretty bad.
I was about to be blown away even more.
I'm sure Jimmy could play in catcher's mitts.
He should play in like some cool fingerless gloves.
In fact, coming up after the top of the hour break, Jeff Faulkner and Steve Ewing are going to be here. They're doing a show together. I just love having local musicians in. I don't think local musicians get enough love. I think in St. Louis, they don't get enough due. And so I have tried for 26 years to do everything I could to support local music. So they'll be up live in studio after that. Rach, what do we have time for? Do we have time for your analog bag? Is that...
Oh, yeah, this is fun. So Gen Z, they're always coming up with fun things
always.
To do. Well, they're starting to carry these bags everywhere. Not all of them, obviously. I want to be clear. Like, I don't think every Gen Z is doing this, but it's a trend amongst Gen Z. They're carrying these bags, usually a tote bag, and they call it their analog bag. And it's basically a bag full of things for them to do whenever they have an extra moment, as opposed to getting on their phone. So if you knit, you bring your yarn and your knitting needles, or you bring a book with you, or all sorts of different things, crafts, crossword puzzles, what have you. And my question for you guys is, if you had an analog bag, what would you put in it?
That is a much harder question than it should be.
Why is that?
Just because I don't play with many analog things anymore.
Well, think back on like what you used to like to do before you became addicted to TikTok.
Yeah.
In the before times.
Does porn fit in a bed?
Because I was thinking, like, this is still a screen, but it's a different kind of screen. But, like, someone like Andrew might like to have a Game Boy Pocket or something.
Yeah.
In there.
Yeah.
Or, like, a book. Or
yeah.
For me, I might have a little sewing project in there, or a little sketch pad. I've never been a huge... I like doing crosswords, but a lot of times I don't know the answer. I'm going to be for real.
Right.
I do like word search.
Oh, I love word
That's
search.
That's a little bit more my speed.
Word search is awesome. I love word search.
Word search is a blast.
Yeah.
I really enjoy doing them.
I do too.
You know what? I should get a book to keep at my house.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Wheels, you still...
I can't think of a damn thing.
Really?
I mean, I...
What would you do if you went home and your power was out and your phone was dead?
Cry. Be the first time in my adult life I just ball.
Be inconsolable.
Yeah. I don't know.
Wow.
Honestly,
if we're talking now, maybe, you know, like the Lord of the Rings or Hobbit books, because I haven't read them in 35, 40 years. So
yeah, what exactly is the question? I was letting our guests.
What would be in your analog bag? So like your tote bag full of things to occupy yourself, to distract you from your phone.
Probably a handful of books. I mean, I've got a couple of, I do most of my reading on my phone, just because it's convenient and, you know, you can do it in downtown at a restaurant or whatever. But, I got a couple of, you know, regular books, so-called. I'd probably throw a couple of
those. One of the great things about Phoebe Summer, she was at a place where she couldn't have her phone other than like an hour a day. And she already read. She could read. But she developed a love for reading.
That's awesome.
And so, yeah, now she's, like, reading all the time. And now she's back from her adventure. She's going to try to be on the phone a little bit less. We'll see.
Okay,
yeah,
nice.
That's great.